on education for September 15th, 2000, in Pasta Gallo, Foods Under Welcome.
And open the side of the committee.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome, members. Thanks for being here today. We have a full agenda to move forward in, and I'd like to remind folks to please turn off your cell phones, your Blackberries, your PDAs, etc., so as not to interfere with the sound system. We would greatly appreciate that. We are going to begin with an informational meeting on the implementation, my mouth isn't working yet, after 4 hours of driving, Senate Bill 379 on the train of child abuse prevention. And we have a panel of folks who are going to discuss where we are on this. We have Morgan Allen, Nancy Latini. Is Nancy here? Oh, there you are. Nancy. And we're all coming together. Nikki Oden and Lori Sexton from the SBA.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and Chair Walker, members of both committees. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and I have two guests with me, Nancy Latini, who's the Assistant Superintendent for Student Learning Partnerships at the Department of Education, and Mickey Odine, who's the Deputy Superintendent of the Northwest Regional ESD, and we're here to give you a brief update on activities that the department and others have undertaken in response to the passage of Senate Bill 379, which, as you remember, created some new responsibilities for school districts and the Department of Human Services when it comes to child abuse reporting and training. So, specifically, if you remember, Senate Bill 379 did four primary things. The first thing it did, it required school districts and other entities identified in the bill to provide school employees training on prevention and identification of child abuse each year, in addition to the mandatory reporting requirement that many of our school employees already have. The second thing it did is it required that that same training that's available to school employees be made available to parents or guardians of students in the school district. So if a student's parent or guardian wanted to view that training, the school districts need to make that available to those parents as well. The third thing it did, it required that school districts make training designed to prevent child abuse available to students in the school district K through 12. And then the fourth thing, it required the Department of Human Services to inform the original reporter about the final determination of a child abuse investigation, as long as it didn't conflict with ORS 419B035. So, again, these provisions apply to all of our public schools, including charter schools, and began in the 2007-2008 school year. So, just to give you a little bit of an update on what the department has done, some specific actions that we've taken is that it should be coming around in the testimony. In the fall of 2007, we distributed a memo to about 2,500 school employees, including all superintendents and principals and a lot of teachers and other folks at the schools, sort of outlining the requirements of the bill and what needs to be done. We've worked with DHS to make sure that training materials on child abuse prevention have gone out to schools and districts, and we've just had, you know, ongoing meetings and coordination with stakeholder groups like OSBA and COSA to make sure that the provisions of Senate Bill 379 are being done. Just a couple anecdotal stories. I think we really need to compliment our ESD partners. They've done an outstanding job in helping facilitate and get these trainings out and made them widely available, and Nikki's going to talk about that a little bit in a moment. And then another thing is technology is a wonderful thing. As you know, the department operates the Oregon Virtual School District, and we've made access to some of these trainings, specifically the one that the Northwest Regional ESD has done online, and we've had over 3,000 people view those training materials online just on our virtual school district website. So, next steps for us, again, we'll just continue to work with stakeholders as anything comes up. Our agency has not received any complaints or comments or concerns from any parents or community members that feel like their school district is not living up to the requirements of the bill. One additional thing that we're going to do is Cindy Hunt, our legal affairs coordinator, and several folks at our agency are working on a fairly complete rewrite and update of the Division 22 administrative rules, which are the rules that many of you know that schools have to comply with in order to be, quote, a standard school in Oregon. And each year, the school superintendent or the ESD superintendent needs to sign off that they're doing all these things. We obviously don't have resources to audit all 197 school districts every year, but we do spot check somewhere probably in the neighborhood of 48 districts every year. And then if we do receive complaints on things related to Division 22, then we can sort of bump those districts up to the top of the line and sort of go out and check and see what's going on gives us just a little bit of a stick to make sure the districts are complying with that. So although, you know, there's nothing in the bill that would require, I think we've decided to include the provisions of Senate Bill 379 in that rewrite. So it will be part of being a standard school when this is massive rewrite. And I think one of the biggest bills you've ever seen in your life is going to be probably, I think there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of components whirling around on the Division 22 rewrites, but it will be in there, and it will be make the provisions of 379 part of being a standard school, so superintendents will have to sign off every year that they're doing this, and again, we'll be spot-checking folks as they do this. So, unless you have any other questions for me, I'll turn it over to Mickey, and she'll talk a little bit about what the Northwest Regional ESD is doing.
Thank you. We will move on with questions to him.
Good afternoon, Chair Walker, Chair Buckley, and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here to represent Northwest Regional ESD and actually the entire ESD community. It was our pleasure to step up and fill a void that we felt was needed in our districts. I am the Deputy Superintendent, Northwest Regional ESD, and I often get phone calls from our districts whenever something comes out that y'all give to us. And they say, so what are you doing about it? So what I say is, I don't know about this yet. And so I did my research and started looking into the situation. And we became quite concerned that we didn't have the capability or the infrastructure, and we weren't ready for this particular piece of legislature. So we decided we needed to get ready. So in about September, you have a little piece of paper that I gave you. Gives you a little brief history here. But in September, we started looking into what we could do. And so in discussions with Multnomah ESD, we began to collaborate in a way to meet the needs outlined for employees and for the parent training piece. Therefore, we were looking at the first two provisions of this bill, and we did not address the provisions for 3 and 4, but we did for the first and the second. We decided that we needed to provide such a training. This committee then grew into a full-fledged committee, which we had representatives from agencies and from three of our ESDs start the work in September. The advisory committee that worked on the content of the online training that we decided that we would offer out were folks from Multnomah and Washington County Commission on Children and Families, CARES Northwest, the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon, DHS, Northwest Regional ESD, MESD, and Clackamas ESD. So we were the original committee that put the content together. We then went to our ESD community and asked if they would help us to do this. So they agreed that they would. They then took upon themselves the charges that would be needed in order to make such a training available. All of the committee members, including myself, of course, accepted no funds whatsoever to get this done. But what we did need to do was to pay folks that were going to actually put this together. The Crisis Management Institute of Salem was contracted to design the online aspects of the course. The online course was completed in March. We beta tested in April, and we went live at no charge to all district employees and parents by mid-April of 2008. The actual training was about $30,000 to put together. All of our ESDs incurred that cost, and they did not pass that on to their districts. They did that amongst themselves. To date, approximately 7,000 employees have been trained, and at the time of the writing of this particular piece, it was in August, and I would assume that there have been many since. I didn't have time to check that this morning before I left. The training itself is the basic information about the course and the CAP link are hosted at ORVSD, and you can see the line that you go to for that. Quite frankly, it is on ORVSD, but it then links directly over to Northwest Regional ESD, and we house this on our web server there. But when you click on there, it'll look as if it's coming directly from ORVSD, which is good. We collect user information, quite frankly, about the course. The course is about an hour in length. Anyone can go on. You can go on. Please feel free to do so. Love to hear your feedback about the course. We are collecting lots and lots of information from people that do call frequently, and I get a lot of questions about the technical aspects of this course, and I have to say I don't know, and I send them on to my technical department, and we have made that commitment out of our tech department to support this entirely so that we can answer those questions. Any content questions, I do try to answer and I will go back to my committee members who are no longer a standing committee, but I'll still call them and ask them for their advice. We have provided a backup database so that we can have a search form that districts can easily use to get a list of their employees who have completed the training. So each district, if they sign up in such a fashion that they have a mailbox, can come on and look in that mailbox at any time and see how many of their employees have actually taken the training. To date, 100% of Northwest Regional ESD employees took the training last year, and we are going to get to that exact same number within the next month or so for this year. That's basically the training in a nutshell, and I certainly would be open to questions as well.
Thank you so much. Members, questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And Mr. Allen, I just have to commend you. You come in here and you're prepared and you deliver cogent testimony. You've done it all day, and I just want to tell you that I appreciate it. I'm excited about this because this was my baby. This is what I wanted to have happen in our schools because I just think it's so important for everybody to have eyes on our children. So I just have a couple of questions, though. One is, I'm not familiar with the Crisis Management Institute in Salem, so I'm going to go on the web when I'm done here, but perhaps you could tell me a little bit about
sure.
them.
The Crisis Management Institute is the CEO of Sherry Lovery, who's been in business of intervening in regards to crises that may occur in schools for, oh my gosh, 20 years or more. She is basically national and has gone international, quite frankly. She gets calls from just about everywhere whenever there is a crisis of any proportion, and she will arrive. She was in Sri Lanka. She basically was very, very knowledgeable about schools and children and crises. The reason that I went to her, quite frankly, is that I've known her for a very long time. We were having lunch. I was grappling with this. I didn't quite know how we would get this done. And she said, I want to show you this great new product that we have. And so she brought out her laptop, and out came this wonderful-looking piece of training, which was for suicide prevention. And I said, this looks great. So as I started moving through the materials, I said, would you be interested in? And I would suggest to you that Sherry herself did not work on the content of this, but she certainly gave us her technical expertise and the folks that she has on board with her to put it together in what we hoped would be an interactive training that would require folks to actually interact with materials, not just be clicking a button. Mm-hmm. They'd have to answer questions. They'd see things happening in front of them that would make them stay engaged with the materials. It's a hard-fought battle, quite frankly, to get this down to 1 hour's worth of training.
All right. Well, we had an example. Was it in a joint committee? We had the example of one company came in.
Yeah,
Shield the Vulnerable. So I'm really anxious to take a look at that, particularly suicide prevention piece, which is another area that I work on. So my second of my third questions is, how often now are you doing the training? So they do it once a year?
It's an annual training available year-round, and folks can get on the computer at any time, wherever they may be. We've been handling questions from all over about, well, gosh, what are you going to do about your bus drivers? How are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? Each and every one of them. And each district has managed in their own way to deal with every group that they have. And as a matter of fact, one of our districts said, well, we just brought all our bus drivers into our computer lab one morning and said, come on, sit down. And that's what they did. So I just applaud the efforts of each district because I think that they're finding ways to make it happen and make it work for kids and for their employees. So.
Okay, and my last question goes to Mr. Allen, if I might. It's indicated that this is accessible to the Oregon Virtual School District. I read an editorial in the Register Guard at one point that not every school is able to access the Oregon Virtual School District. And I think that they were talking about private schools. So tell me, who can access the Oregon Virtual School District? Every single school in Oregon, charter, private, public, or just certain schools?
Chair Buckley and Senator Walker, I think I need to get back to our staff and double check that for the 100% accurate answer, but I believe it is only public entities. So that would be public schools, charter schools, and other things within the public realm have free access to the content of the virtual school district. So, I need to check that and confirm that. But I'm not familiar with the editorial and have vaguely heard this topic come up once or twice in my time at the department, but I can check and get you the specific
information. I have the editorial floating around my office somewhere, but I remember reading it, and I was being asked about it, and now the time has come, so I'll search for it. And the final comment is, Ms. Oden, I want to thank the ESDs. I have to tell you, I have a tremendous amount of respect for ESDs. It's grown over my service in the legislature, particularly as I've interacted with them around the state. I really appreciate that frontline assistance you're able to give to school districts. It's so far removed to go to the Department of Ed, I have to tell you that. So I appreciate that you're right there, able to give the service, and that you folks took the lead on this, because frankly, no one really was. And I was asking about it, and everyone was going, what do we do? What do we do? So you showed an example of what the ESDs are meant to do and how they can get it done.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Compton.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. And this may not be something to have information on, but Nancy, in your highlight here, your report, the area of interest that I'd like to hear a little bit about, and I don't know if DHS has given us any information about getting or how they're getting information back to the people that report abuse.
Representative Buckley and Senator Walker, I don't know if they're representatives of DHS here, but they would need to handle that specific update. We are not involved with that, so if someone's here from DHS, we'd be happy to cede the table to them to answer that question. But that provision is not specific to our agency, and
right.
That's not something we deal with. So.
Okay. I'll wait and hold on.
Thank you, Representative. We'll bring DHS up in a minute then to get that answer. Further questions? I have a couple of questions myself, and just to clarify, in going to the website then, when you log in as guest, open the course, is that you just get to review the course, you get to take the test?
Get to take the test.
Thank you. And so does this mean then, is material age appropriate? If there's high school students who would get on this, would that be a big concern?
You know, that's the first time that question has been asked, Representative Buckley. I would assume yes, it is. I don't think that there's anything in the training that wouldn't be something that a high schooler would be able to take in pretty easily.
Which brings the next question: what are the plans, or are there plans to address items 3 and 4 from the bill to make the training available to students in this?
I think, Mr. Chair, we would cede that question to Lori from OSDN. She's got some information.
And Mr. Allen, just a quick question on Division 22, the timeline for that rewrite, is that intended to be completed for the next session?
Mr. Chair, I could ask Cindy Hentz when that is scheduled, but I obviously did not bring a draft today because there isn't one. But I can update the chairs and Ms. Richardson as that is available. But it is something that we've been wrestling with. It's quite an overcall. So.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for these guests of the committees? Thank you very much. Greatly appreciate it. Lori, do you want to come up and give some comments from the OSBA side of it all?
Mr. Chair, Lori Satin, still for the Oregon School Board Association. Chair, and committee members. As a request of the education committees, we here to report today what the districts are doing. What I did was compiled some questions that we sent out on SurveyMonkey. We asked the districts, how are they training teachers? When? Who's doing it? And if they needed help with implementation. And then we asked them with parents, what are you doing for parents? When? Who's doing the training? And what kind of help do you need? And then we did it with students as well, the same set of questions. What I got back was 120, and I thought this was pretty good information. And I did bring it today because I thought Senator Walker may want to read through them all.
I think I do.
to paraphrase, all the districts are doing something or out there searching for what they can use. Online seems to be the popular one for staff. There's various ways that they're doing that. They give a staff member maybe a time frame to get it done, and they give them their options. I've seen use of DHS, lots of Northwest Regional ESD responses in my survey, and you've heard a lot about that. Jumping to parents, what they're doing is a lot of handout materials, and they're trying to do that or talk with the parents during student conferences, back-to-school nights. There's a few districts that said, you know, we could use some help here because we're not getting them engaged, you know, in the discussion. They may just take the materials and it's and you'll be able to see it. It's pretty apparent in the material. Those seem to be what they're doing for parents. For students, pretty much curriculum-based in the classroom. And overwhelmingly, the biggest issue they have is age-appropriate material for the younger students. So with that, we need to figure out what we're going to do, you know, there. With all the Northwest Regional ESD responses, what I did, I went and logged on because I was like, I want to try this. And then as a parent, so I logged in and as a guest, and I thought, oh, my gosh, they're going to know it. Somebody in from OSBA. And it made me think. It really did, because you read it and then you have to answer. And I'm like, oh, no, it's going to ask me to answer. And then... but they give you kind of a hint they're going to ask you some answers. So I really have to pay attention. And then I thought, oh, this is going to take more brain power than an hour that I have. And so I bookmarked it so I could come back. But I encourage all of you to try it, go online, and really review it. It's good material. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. So some of the districts are struggling with age-appropriate curriculum. You're assisting them with that?
You know, we've got to work on that. I'm not quite sure where to go with that. And it's the younger kids.
Right, I can imagine that. Kindergarten, first grade, second grade. Those tend to be the most vulnerable children,
exactly.
Too, because they trust adults. Can you give me a timeline of what you mean you're going to be working on that? What does that mean to you?
Are you going to give me a timeline?
No, this is the school year, the beginning of the school year, and they're not getting training because obviously they don't have age-appropriate curriculum.
Well,
we have that done by spring.
They didn't say that they weren't doing any training. They're just struggling with age-appropriate material. So I need to go back and call a few of these and say, what exactly do you mean? Get a sort of a better sense of what that means. Because I don't know what that means specifically.
Representative Buckley did mention, you know, there are three parts to the bill: parents, teachers, and staff. And so it sounds like we're getting the parents, but they're kind of like not tuned in. They get overwhelmed a little bit with material.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I did suicide prevention workshops, my children were in high school, and you get maybe 50 parents show up out of the school of 800 to 1,000 kids, and that's like not very many. So it's sort of, I think, making sure that the materials, if you're going to hand out materials, making sure they're available to the parent-teacher associations, mm-hmm. Site councils.
Yeah, those are listed in here.
Okay, well, I want to, use that. I want to read through there and sort of come up with some new ideas. But I do want to hear back from you about what you're doing about that age-appropriate curriculum.
I'll work with COSA.
That'd be a good idea. And the ESD. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. And this is more of a comment than asking for a response. And coming from a community that a large percentage of our children and parents speak more, don't have English as a first language, it is critical importance that materials be developed in multiple languages. And I know that that's probably not foremost in people's minds, but in some school districts where up to, in Woodburn now, we're anywhere between 70 and 80% of our children are students of second language. We really do need to have materials developed as soon as possible in several other dominant languages.
Further questions? Seeing none, Thank you very much. Could we have Mickey, Sarah, and Stacey here from VHS? One or both? Let's go. Come forward. Gentlemen, if you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. If not, sure, we'd like to see questions.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families with the Department of Human Services, and I'd like to introduce you to our new statewide Child Protective Services Manager, Stacey Ayers, and this will be, we're introducing Stacey to the legislative process, so this will be his first time testifying in front of the committee, so please be gentle.
Mr. Chair, aren't we supposed to be mean to them the first time?
I thought that was the tradition, yes.
I believe that's on the legislative side,
oh, I see.
Not the executive branch. And I believe there was a question about the reporting.
Please raise your question.
Well, the question, Mickey, is let's say a teacher reports to DHS, are reports getting back to that teacher? That's a simple question.
Well, and Chair Buckley and Representative Kopp, I think the simple answer is we don't know for sure. What we do know is that when the legislation passed and this particular bill had an emergency clause with it, we partnered with the Oregon Judicial Department and did the legislative roadshow, and this was one of the key bills that we talked to the communities about. We provided training to, the best I can remember, it was a few thousand staff. These were DHS staff, school officials, primarily teachers, and then we had a number of managers and DHS that were attending as well as the courts and some other community partners that would have an interest in other pieces of legislation. The feedback we were getting is that the school districts felt like that was improving. In central office, we have received, I personally have received a couple of calls where we had to research to see why someone did not get back with the school official, and one was an error, just we did not get back with them. The other was tied to an investigation. I think some of you may know that if there's a criminal investigation taking place, we have some difficulty sharing information or even talking about whether or not we've opened the case for an assessment. We're encouraging staff, even in those circumstances, to at least call the reporter back and let them know that we received the call and we are looking into it and maybe not go beyond that in terms of the information that we share. And that is a cultural shift for our staff right now. We don't have the capability in our data system to track the mandatory reporter the day that they put the call in to the department. However, we are revising the statewide automated system, and I checked 2 weeks ago, and there will be a component that will allow us to pull when that report came in, who that reporter was, and what action was taken with that reporter. That should go into effect, last I heard, was 2010, a little over a year from now.
2010, I think, yeah, that is a good bit of a year. No, the only comment, Chair Buckley, is that I really appreciate the steps you've made in improving the system, because my experience as a school administrator is teachers would report, they would come back to me and say, well, have you heard something from, you know, what's happening? And it is a real gap, because while they have that child in their classroom, they don't know what's happening. And so, I just appreciate the work that you're doing and encourage you to move forward swiftly.
Just to follow on your concern, the testimony was that the department is encouraging that would you like to see more encouragement?
Well, we need to go back and look at the bill. I think if the bill says that they may or shall, it makes a big difference. And if it says shall, then we need to be wrong.
We had a lot of conversation about that section of the bill.
Let's begin. And Representative
Cerise remembered that.
And Representative Buckley, I think you're right that we are to get back with the reporter. The bill specifically talks about school teachers. The way our policy reads, it's all reporters, so we've broadened that a bit. The word I chose, encouraging, is more around moving our culture to do that in a consistent manner, but you're exactly right. We need to get back with a reporter, regardless of who that reporter is, to let them know that we at least received the call, and then other information as the circumstance permits.
Well, the follow-up is, as much as a teacher is important, and we've had multiple discussions in the interim about, well, coaches in a negative term, but we have many coaches that do make these reports that are not school employees, and so it's another layer of a challenge to, if a coach is using the school facility making the report, and yet they don't leave their home number or some way to contact them, so the system, the school system, also will have a shared responsibility in making sure that information is given so that that can happen too. So it goes both ways.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right after I was appointed in 2003, I got called Friday afternoon at like 4:30, and it was a constituent was concerned about his daughter and his wife's boyfriend, and he was saying there was sexual abuse going on. Remember the training, what do I do? And I tried to call DHS, and my background, I wanted some proof that I'd reported it. I did see something happening that weekend to this poor child, and I said, I want to be sure I did my thing. I've talked to Mickey about this, so I think this whole thing about reporting and feedback, we need to tighten up. I had a tough time and finally got the case off to send me an email, or I sent them an email. They gave me their address so I knew that at least had reported it before something terrible went. That was, and it wasn't as bad as, you know, later the case worker called back and they monitored the situation and what was going on. But I, as a reporter, I was really concerned that this information was taken care of and the child was protected, one, but also that I'd done my timely reporting as a mandatory reporter. So I think this is something we need to continue to work on and tighten up and have, you know, here's your reference number, you reported or something. I don't know how it can be done, but it needs to be done.
So I guess I will ask in terms of the development of materials in Ms. Latini's testimony here. Written testimony, she mentions that DHS is also preparing an updated video and booklet to be accessible by the web, which may be helpful in training at a district level. Is DHS working with ODE, Department of Human Services, working with the Department of Education to make sure the material that is being put forward is consistent?
Representative Buckley. My name is Stacey Ayers. I'll give you my spiel here. My name is Stacey Ayers, and I am an employee with the Department of Human Services with children, adults, and families. And I am the program manager for the Protective Services Unit. I've worked for the agency since 1995. We, at this point, I'm not aware that we're working in conjunction with DOE on that particular point. I am aware, though, that we have information available on the Oregon website that is the training video, the DVD, and is accessible that way. You can download it, and the booklets, the pamphlets that go along with what you can do about child abuse are also available. That answers your question.
Thank you. It does. I was just hoping that we have at least some way to communicate between the two agencies to make sure that we're putting out consistent information, not anything that might be conflicting. I don't know if anybody's in charge of reviewing that.
And Representative Buckley, at this point, I'm not sure that anything has been done on that, but I can certainly follow up.
Further questions?
May I ask?
There's an agreement, of course.
Thank you, sir. This isn't exactly the topic that we're in right now, but you could, just while you're here in front of these committees, talk a bit about where you're going with trying to deal with the problems of Children and Protective Services. In terms of staffing issues and a variety of other things. I think it came up in Mackenzie's letter. Would it be appropriate to ask just a little bit, or is this out of the way?
We're always on the edge of order.
Which side?
The answer to that is yes. If you have a response.
Chair Buckley and Representative Greenlake, and yes, I can give you some information. We do have, as you mentioned, the McKinsey study, and during the February supplemental session, we reported the child welfare staffing study, which was part of the McKinsey work, and we're in phase two working with McKinsey even as we talk. I think we're about halfway through phase two right now. The study did identify a staffing gap that we have in the department. We also identified some efficiencies that we believe will help us narrow that gap, and that's what we're working on currently in phase two. So we have a series of rapid improvement processes that are taking place. In fact, they've just begun. I think we've done about six or seven of those, and the idea is to reduce the amount of time that it takes to do some of the work that we believe takes away from the casework that caseworkers need to do in terms of building relationships with clients or working clients more successfully toward reunification. So it's a long-term plan. It's something that we plan to roll out over several months pretty aggressively, and then hopefully we will begin seeing some of those efficiencies. The next legislative session, we will be talking about the staffing studies that we've used in the past, and those will be moving to a workload study in the future. And one of the concerns that we found in the McKinsey report was that as time goes by and we have mandates as a state agency from the federal government, maybe from state legislation, from our own administrative rules or our own policies and procedures, we begin to add workload in terms of increments, and that's not measured in terms of a staffing study like an FTE. So you can't get an FTE when you're asking a worker to spend 90 seconds more of time. But when you multiply that times 4,500 workers, it begins to mount up in terms of the workload. And across time, that has created a gap of about 24 to 37% was the estimate that McKinsey came up with. And rather than move toward looking at that and saying that we need to fill that gap immediately with staff, we're saying that there are some inefficiencies that we also noted through the studies, and if we can work on those inefficiencies first, we think we can narrow the gap and give us a little bit more of a truer figure of what we might need to meet the workload of the casework staff in the future. Is that close to you?
Well, I thank you very much. We'll explore it more, I think.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your time. Is there anyone else here who wishes to speak on Senate Bill 379 and how it's being rolled out? If not, I would close the informational meeting on the Senate Bill 379 and open up an informational meeting on the issue of protecting children from sexual abuse in schools. The link that both our committees has been focused on for several months now. Our administrator has prepared a quite extensive binder. If you haven't looked through it yet, you get a lot of information in that. We basically have just kind of review where we are from our previous meeting in June. We did talk about seven legislative concepts that look forward at that point. Two legislative council for drafting. I'll ask our administrator to review those briefly. Then we have our two work groups that have met and worked on additional possible recommendations. So, is there someone who'd be so kind as to remind us of what we begin in June?
Yep, happy to. So the binders are set up. You've got your Senate Bill 379 at the beginning. After the first screen page is the list of proposals that the joint committees agreed to have drafted in June, and then each of the associated LCs. The next set is the set of information from the fingerprinting work group and those associated LCs. And then the very last set of information. Mine was, I guess it was the third green sheet of just LCs and topics that were discussed by quote-unquote further support groups. So, Mr. Chair, we can do this however you like. My thought would be we'll just kind of take one by one and ask questions, and we've got most of the council here. We have other participants and knowledgeable folks here. We just kind of start plugging through.
That sounds very good. And then just to remind you, we are reviewing this material. Senator Walker and I, I'm sure, will be discussing this after this meeting, but in our October meeting, we'll decide which House committee bills go forward, which will be Senate committee bills.
So when we met in June, we talked about the New Mexico statute that provided that these confidential agreements, if they were out there, and to the extent that they are, having one would not preclude the duty to report. So then you have the associated legislative draft, or the legislative context associated with that, which is 1167. And I'll read you the kind of catch line there, that prohibits education providers and current or former school employees from entering into an agreement for the purpose of affecting the provider's duty to investigate the suspected child abuse, to report the suspected child abuse, or to discipline the employee. It declares an emergency and be effective upon passage.
Discussion?
Yeah.
We just got this material today, so again, don't worry about the specific language in here, but the questions have already jumped up about time to bring them up. So, Chris?
Not that I'm objecting to this, it just kind of seems to me that if they entered into a confidentiality agreement, it's after the fact and already should have been reported. Do you see where I'm going?
Could I comment?
Yeah.
I think sometimes with confidentiality agreements, the idea is it doesn't rise to the level, and it's trying to kind of split the difference between something that, you know, we can't say for sure that it didn't happen, and yet, or did or didn't happen, you know, we're uncomfortable, we just assume not have this employee. Is that simple?
Well, I guess, you know, as a mandatory reporter, you're supposed to report suspected. So I guess my question here is, if you have entered into an agreement, a termination agreement, a confidentiality agreement, based on something you suspected, you should have already reported it long before you get the agreement slip. So
this is out of our right. Consider, if I can comment, I think you make an excellent point. And part of this discussion has revolved around, is our system already strong enough, given the legislation that was passed in 2005 and 2007? There seems to have been a concern that it isn't enough, that we have to somehow make it so clear that it's like a neon light that says, you know, not only are you required to report it, but if you didn't report it, you still can't enter into one of these agreements. That's if I follow the discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Mr. Chair, maybe it got down. Maybe New Mexico doesn't have mandatory requirements, so that's why they have this in law. But this seems to be. To get to the point where you have signed a confidentiality agreement, it's gone a step beyond suspicions where you may have something but not enough to substantiate. So at that point in time, if you're a school official, you haven't reported it, it's breaking the law. So anyway, that's just my comment on that. I'm not sure that makes sense to me, but.
I think as we move forward, this bill would either get your support or not, and you might be able to make the argument that we don't need it. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grinda.
Can I ask a question, please?
Please.
This, we're talking about 1167.
Correct.
1167 uses the term educational provider. It's not defined in this term. We'll see it later on. Is that school or person or what does it mean? Where is it defined?
Good to see you.
Thank you. I'll be here very soon. Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Hannah Lai. I'm Legislative Counsel, and I had fun with your 15 drafts here. In answer to your question, Representative Greenleg, education provider is defined in ORS 339370, which is not part of this draft. And it includes school districts, and then includes like the School of the Deaf, School of the Blind, Oregon Youth Authority, private schools. I think there's about 7 different items on that list.
You say it's in
339.370.
370. So it's a far away.
Yes, it's just the definition section for the series.
Thank you.
Welcome.
I would call her up, by the way. I think she's going to stay here for a while.
I'll just make myself comfortable.
Did I miss something?
In response to your previous question, Senator, I struggled with this draft because of the same reason, is that these people are mandatory reporters, and so kind of what I saw this draft is doing is being able to provide a vision where somebody can point to it and say, see, you absolutely cannot do this, which when you have a shall, I think that's already fairly clear, but this spells it out in black and white if that is a concern, as people do not understand right now.
Thanks, Senator. Any further comments or questions on LC 1167? See you Ms. Richardson.
The next one is LC 1170. And the idea here is if the license has been revoked by another state, we should automatically deny it here in Oregon. And to recap, I'm not sure what this attempts to do.
Any questions, concerns?
Thank you. Sure. We don't know what all the other states' rules are. Yes. Well, if there's a state that has a rule that says,
Senator Haas, I don't know if that's been done yet. What this language does provide is that the commission, the Teacher Standards and Practice Commission, can look and determine if that other jurisdiction is substantially equivalent, so they look at it that way. And then the second sentence here is that there is a whole due process where they can go through and, you know, just determine if this other state just can review that they have the right process in place. Should we follow what they do? So there should be enough.
Nothing procedure. I would not take 49
other states. Can I, because it takes me a while for my brain to get around because I agree with Senator Cruz earlier. Can I ask a question about the previous one? Just fairly quickly to counsel there.
You go for it.
My issue here is that if there are reasons to have confidentiality agreements that would have nothing to do with this, would having a statute like this give cause to party to say, I would like a judge or a third party to review the other confidentiality agreement to see if there was anything in it that precluded them talking about a sexual abuse issue. Because we can't always look at them, and somebody may believe that that was it, and currently there's no way to find out if there was in that confidentiality agreement regarding that particular statement. Would this give a judge the ability to look at the confidentiality agreement?
Representative, I think it could. We're only looking at the actions of the person. They are suspected of committing the child abuse, not what the agreement is related to. And so that should open up all sorts of agreements. Well, yeah.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions on the first two?
Follow up on the student
right. Representative?
I'm still puzzling that one a little bit. LC 1222 defines school, defines an education provider in a certain way. Is that different than it is in the 339-370?
Very good eyes, Representative. That is the basis
370 was the basis for 1222. It, the only difference is that 1222 does not include the private school. And that was just something I did as I was drafting that, something that we could debate about, or you guys can debate about as a policy issue. But yes, for the most part, that is the definition of 370.
But the others do include private school.
The private school is used for the mandatory reporting provisions. And since boundary violation didn't rise to the same level as abuse, I just did not include it. But again, that is a policy decision that you can talk about.
So this confidentiality agreement does apply to private school. Yeah, 1166.
1166,
correct.
Okay, we'll get to
12.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Is there an appeal provision in 1170 so that if there is a situation like the Senator was suggesting, maybe another state has a provision that, you know, maybe we wouldn't agree with or whatever, or there was a mistake, is there an appeal provision somewhere?
Somewhat, Representative. There is the provision to use the reinstatement procedures that the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission uses for their own actions. So it does basically puts this person at the same standing as somebody who had an action against them in Oregon, so they can go through that same process.
Yeah, I point out that this is just permissive language and allows PSPC to deny if they were revoked for something.
Actually, Senator, it is mandatory. It is saying, if you look at subsection 3 in the paragraph A, it's saying that no license or registration shall be issued to a person who has had this teaching license revoked in another jurisdiction. Oh, sorry, section 1, subsection 3. Starting on page 1, the read-in is that paragraph A at the bottom of page 1.
That's all current law.
Well, that's
except
current law, and now you're adding this one.
Right.
Adding
an E. Right.
So it will be automatically revoked. If it's substantially equivalent, which will be defined by you. If there's a loopy state out there. I love that.
And the question.
But it says indeed the new language that is substantially equivalent. Okay, so they will revoke, but not necessarily. For example, if state X has revoked for something that is not a revocable offense in Oregon, it won't be revoked because it's not substantially equivalent.
That's correct.
So that's the catch. What Senator Haas was talking about. This isn't in all cases. It's when it's for an offense that we would be for.
That's
okay.
Thank you, Senator. Or is it really?
I guess, it's about the revoking. There's a question on the form I'm going to ask that asks specifically if they have had a revoke in another state.
That I'm not aware of what the
I'm getting a nod
from PSBC.
So if they choose to answer that one incorrectly, that's enough to dismiss them.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Any further discussion on the first two?
This is
I was feeling when we get to number 4 or 5, we're going to go back to the first two.
I wanted an answer.
Is there still LC-1171?
This was, the idea here was to prohibit districts from entering into any contract or agreement that has the effect of suppressing information about verbal or physical abuse or sexual misconduct. This was to include, we asked, some element of school district's obligation to check references and to record the reference checks. This was modeled on a statute in Washington State.
Okay.
I think Chris and Wilson wants to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1167. So what if the school what if the school provider doesn't do this? Do they get this?
One thing that you can consider putting in some stronger provisions.
Yeah, I understand it's a draft. I looked at that and I thought there's nothing. You know, do they lose their position? They don't get paid? So, you know, what was the school board?
And that, I'm not terribly certain how any of this is enforceable right now, since maybe you're not been a non-conforming school and it may affect your funding. That's why I see most of this comes into play is here. In relation to your funding.
Right. I think if we go through, we need to at least consider some language.
Specify
the consequence of what happens if we don't do this.
Yes, sir. For the mandatory reporting that everybody else in here has to follow, it's a Class A violation fined by $750 that did not carry over to the education statutes. I don't know why that's just the way it's drafted and make that something.
Which LC are we on?
Just a question. In section one.
On what?
On 71?
Well, we keep going back.
Back and forth. Are you on
71
now?
That's we can fine. Be. That's fine.
Were you open on 71?
I did, absolutely. Yeah. I took Representative Wisdom back, but please proceed on.
Oh, okay. I'm trying to stay on.
You're doing great. Consider Wander confusing.
Page 1, line 14 through 18, Hannah, where it says, line 16 and 17, not otherwise protected by law.
Yes.
Is a confidentiality agreement protected by law?
I would say no, if it's not legal. So the thing that I'm trying to pick up with this is maybe it's something that's protected by attorney-client privilege.
Okay. But that would be my one question. So by your interpretation of this, if there is a confidentiality agreement and it does deal with the subject area, they would be required to disclose.
That's correct, because further into the statute section, we are saying such agreements are void and unenforceable, and as a result, it would not be legally protected.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions or concerns, comments on C1171? Very good.
LC 1172 was we wanted to make it fine for school employee to have sex with a student who is in kindergarten to grade 12, regardless of the student's age.
Pretty straightforward so far. Any questions, comments?
Regardless of the student's age, so the 3-year difference is not allowed.
Some members, what I did with this is I looked at the least offensive elements of the crime, like the least offensive rape or sodomy or whatever, and added this language about the teacher. So really the effect of this is to pick up, for the most part, 18 to 21 year olds. There are some of the statutes that only apply to 16 years of age and older, so that also pick up the 16, 17, 18 year olds. So it's mostly getting those older age groups because we already have so many strong laws for the younger ages, regardless of the relationship.
There is a real bit.
The only question I have is, do we have a definition of a person who is an employee who is in a position of authority?
Very good eyesight. No, Representative, we do not. And that's something I discussed with our criminal law drafter, and we just kind of backed off on that and thought, well, that might be good to kind of leave a little vague. But if you want to go in and make absolutely clear what you're thinking about, then yes, we can define that.
Because the other... If I can continue.
Yes, please.
The other statute is pretty clear that any school employee commits this act if it's pre-order. But this one seems to, by definition, by famous definition, exclude part of that population. We just don't know. So if an elementary teacher was having an affair with a high school student that was a
they would probably not have any direct authority over that. Therefore, they would not be an issue. The same would be true of a bus driver who was not a bus driver of that student, or if that student didn't take the bus. So there would be a whole lot of people who are currently would be affected by the time that it was left on that working school. This would exclude me. And I'm not saying whether we should or shouldn't, I'm just saying that it certainly, by my reading of this, and by having a different definition without it's not defined, the court would have to figure that out.
That's correct, Representative. It does take into account a different group of people, and that position of authority would pick up a situation such as where a student is at a different school than where the student usually attends, such as for, you know, a choir concert or something. But it also pick up the non-school employees, such as the coach.
Right.
And so it definitely does target a different audience.
Good point, Representative. Thank you. Sarah Cruz.
Representative Roland made a very good point here. And this is a really small subset, potentially. I mean, it doesn't take into account, for example, volunteer coaches or volunteer anything at this point. I mean, I'm wondering if an amendment might be on 9/11 to just put the word or in, so the person involved in the sexual act is a school employee or in position of authority. Because then it would be all school employees or volunteers in positions of authority.
Depends on what we want.
I mean, that would be just maybe a suggestion.
Yeah. I appreciate it. So does it does seem to be a desire to move forward with this,
Mr. Chair,
concept?
Explain again why this has a 16-year-old at this section, or a student in 12th grade or above. But in other places, it definitely has. Again, the next section is under 14 or a student. I expect somebody is under 14 and not defined in the scheme of grade 12 or below. Would that be special ed students?
I don't know.
Where am I looking? I think I'm in the right.
You're the right graph.
Yeah. It's on the second page, line 6 and 7, page 2.
Well,
it applies either to a 14-year-old, either an under 14, or a student in grade 12 or below. It's hard to is A contained in B?
Page 3.
I'm sorry, page 3. Well, but the same thing goes on in page 2 on
correct.
In line 19 and 20, but in that case, it's a 16-year-old.
You'd be correct that there, if the language is very specific and very defined, there is going to be some overlap, and that was more just to add consistency throughout all these statutes. So we didn't make it age specific.
I'm not worried about overlap. I'm worried about underlap and whether it creates confusion in some cases. As well, they're in B but not in A or something. I mean, I'm not sure the purpose of it. If A is included in B, then I'm not sure why both are there.
Well, the A would address the age no matter what your relationship is with the person. I mean, that's no matter what. It's 14 no matter what. And B is looking more at a relationship between the two actors.
And there's a real join in here.
Part of the reason is that, say, I moved from another state and I am married to one of my students, and I was legal to get married at 16 years old in the other state, and now I'm married and moved to this new state. Have I committed a crime if that student is going to school and I was legally married in another state?
Yeah. What's the question?
Yeah.
That's my problem.
I mean, without this, it would make it a crime.
Without
the exception.
That's not an exception. I'm talking about 163.401.
That's true.
I'm talking
that's
about
true.
Page 3, line 6 and 7, where I'm certain, well, I was asked if there are instances where somebody could be under 14 and not in grade 12 or below, or is it more inclusive because in B you're talking only about a person in a position of authority? A, I guess, means what, anybody?
Representative, I think what this out of language does in all situations is expands the number of the people we are looking at.
It does expand.
We're going, it mostly addresses the higher age brackets, not the lower ones.
Is it A is a crime regardless of the relationship? If you've got it in that statute.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I should probably know this, but the grade student, grade 12.
That's just what we were going for, was everybody in public schools, like grade 12 and below.
Like grades, public schools, higher than grade 12.
The request was just to do the grade 12 and below.
Instead of all schools.
Instead of all schools.
Further questions, comments on LC 1172? Seeing none. Kristen.
1173 was to create a right of action for parents of a student who is abused by a repeat offender if the previous superintendent covered up those previous offenses. 1173.
Questions, comments, concerns? It must seem straightforward enough, Ms. Richardson, so.
Legislative concept 1174 was to require more reporting to the school board. It was really basically that open-ended, so. It came out with a draft that required public schools to submit reports to school board district boards regarding certain employee activity.
Questions, comments, or concerns of LC 1174?
Only a question.
Chair Walker.
Well, I suppose some school districts do it and some don't already, and so this just requires all school districts to do it.
Is it a little bit?
Lower standard for charter schools,
they may.
I am.
Interesting.
Representative, the reason why is because the charter schools have a definite report that they have to submit, so they could submit it as part of that instead of as part of this July 1 report.
But if they forgot, if they didn't put it into that one, then it would be a May.
The May is to say that they could do it, yes, in that report, but they shall submit the report overall. It's just the May is when they decide to do it.
But they are.
They are required to do it.
LC 1175, we need to ask to see language to prohibit persons being disciplined by TSPC, Sorry Teacher Standards Practices Commission, that is, their license has been revoked or suspended from working in another position in that district in which they work.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Greenlee.
Does this only include the teacher or administrator license? Not other
certificates
that are
issued by TSPC. Yep. That would be all I think we would address, Representative.
Who do you think
we're missing? Oh, yes, this would only be the administrators and the teachers.
We have a comment I don't understand.
In response to the gallery, I think we get there based on the context of the rest of the statute. Because looking at subsection 1, you're talking about suspend or revoke the license or registration of the teacher administrator. That's the foundation of this statute. And that would, I would say that carries on to subsection 3 to pick up the same group of people.
So a counselor who carries something called what? A There's something called a personal services, something or other. All right. I'll talk more about that tomorrow.
Chair is a member of the committee for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards Practices. In our statutory definitions, the definition of teacher includes all people that we license, which includes the folks on personnel service licenses as well. So the statute has always covered teachers, administrators, school counselors, school psychologists.
Yes.
Would it include custodian, assistant to a teacher, those kinds of things?
Chair's representative Robel, no, it would not. We have no jurisdiction over other school employees.
Other questions or comments on this draft?
It needs fixed. I think it should be, my opinion is it should be school employee. And if they're, it doesn't fit, yeah, it doesn't fit the statute.
Where's that come?
In comment to Senator Walker, I believe in the subgroup we looked at all school employees. This one is just the one that dealt with teacher standards and practices.
Mm-hmm.
All school employees who go through the Department of Education. Right.
Do we have that? Could I come up with
this? Yes, please.
But I think the difference between the two ideas is this prohibited employment within that district where they've been employed. The other draft that we'll look at prohibits employment at other, in other positions where you have unsupervised direct contact with children, regardless if it's in that district or in some other employer or division.
The other one is specific to child abuse and those things. This one is not.
The other one is when an investigation is underway.
For?
One of the joints, just because I know other questions come up, I want to be up and down.
Yes.
Hold on just a second. I'm going to get to make sure we get this.
That's
just question, answer, to your satisfaction, or we're still looking at this?
I mean, the issue is this particular statute includes any kind of revocation of license for any of the number of reasons that they can be licensed. The other one that we were talking about, I assume, was about an investigation of sexual abuse.
Chair's Representative Roland, the 1175 would prevent anybody we license who was suspended or revoked from being hired to be a teacher assistant or a coach or some other job in the district while their license was, while they were unable to be licensed as a teacher. And the other one was prohibit them from working anywhere while they're on paid administrative leave under the 379. You're welcome.
Representative Greenland.
Yeah. I'm still interested in, I guess, what's in ORS 342.120, I think. And the question of what a teacher is. That is defining people are responsible for instruction, defining that as direction of learning in class, small groups, individual situation, library, and guidance or counseling. It does not include the provision of related services. Who would be included in not including, who would be excluded from this particular LC under not being, not providing related services.
Representative Green, you know, it's either all or nothing. Mike, I believe what you're asking me is who wouldn't we license?
Who would be involved in school?
Well, speech-language pathologists do not have to have our license. Anybody who's providing services other than direct instruction special education or things like that that would require direct instruction.
Like social work.
Right. Depends on what service they're providing. If it was required under an IEP and it could come under other related services under 343, they would not have to have our license.
So those are people who aren't included in this LC as well. They're essentially the other school employees who aren't included in this. Or included under other school employees.
Representative Greenlee, correct. A lot of those are under contracts and in other type of employment arrangements, and Ms. Lantini is the expert on this.
Can I take your excuse? I'm sorry, the note that I'm referencing?
Yes.
It's in the definition of what a teacher. It's in the definition of who the commission licenses.
Right.
And it's. Sorry, I pulled away.
It's 342.120.
342.126, I think.
Yeah, there's several of them that relate all in the definitions. It says if you spend public funds to deliver direct instruction, and then it defines direct instruction, and it defines teacher. So you have to read three of them to get to one.
Vision of related services. Like children with disabilities.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, are you indicating that this 1175 should apply to a broader set of people or in your background?
I believe the discussion is broader, but again, doesn't that come back down to who is licensed or registered by PSPC? So if this bill has to do only with defining that group, it's definitely because might be suggesting that we expand that to be to also include individual or a contractor for education.
We're being in the universal PSPC here and their authority. And
right.
If we want to talk about other folks, then we can do it under another cover under different authority.
Okay.
We're not going to expand who their licensing in this way.
Right. Maybe this will come up in a discussion from the fingerprint group concerning volunteers and buildings.
Oh,
thank you so much, Senator. Let's note this and then see where we go with it. But I do understand the challenge we're facing with not trying to mix and match what we're trying to do with PSPC and the situation.
I think we may have more discussion.
Absolutely. Any other questions or concerns on LC 1175?
From the committee's last sentence, we have discussed allowing the state to take action against the license regardless of the amount of time that the license has served since the license had expired. This was actually addressed within the fingerprinting work group LC 1169, so we'll talk about what that one looks like when we get there. And then lastly, I'd like to note we had asked to see language requiring DAs to notify TSPC when they prosecute licensed educators. Well, that's already on the books. And it's in your packets. It's ORS 181525. And I believe Ms. Chamberlain felt like it was worth still talking about, regardless of the fact that it is on the books.
I think that kind of the root and the heart of a lot of these things, just because it's there doesn't mean it happens. So if there's a way we can encourage this to happen more or more consistently, It would be wonderful.
How would you suggest doing
that? that's the question.
I honestly don't know. This might be something we want to talk with as a committee. There's a whole area here where crimes get negotiated down out of the mandatory area, even though really the conduct may have merited the higher crime. But in order to save money and prevent a trial, they may negotiate a lesser crime. And all of those things are real related here. But I think the publicity may help in terms of the stories and things. But we don't have a good connection to the hearing from DAs when things may be happening.
All right. That's something we have to get into. If anyone has suggestions, there will be opportunities.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that the president of the session, we bring them in and say, the law is fairly specific. If you received a disposition report, you're supposed to tell people you received it. It's not an
we have to pass a new law.
So why aren't you sharing that report with those two law students?
We'll have that discussion. It'll be fun. All right. Thank you, members, for hanging here thus far. We are now moving to the work groups. And let's see here. Senator Cruz gets to hold forth here, I think, on the fingerprinting of the work group. Do your best, Senator.
Okay. We were, the first mistake I made was indicating to my chair that I'd do whatever she wanted.
She put you
on the chair of the work group, so I should have been more specific. We were tasked by the Joint Committee about 10 things to consider. And the first one was to require higher education. School of Education faculty to complete a fingerprint background check. We discussed that at length, and weren't sure what the purpose would be or what we would do with the information if we got. So we, as a work group, chose to just have questions. Okay. The second one was allow the state to take action against student teachers or program candidates. That became LC 1232. And the purpose behind this was if we have somebody, why let somebody in the program go all through the program or jump through the hoops if they're not going to be licensed, if they're not something other in the program that requires that relocation, let's go ahead and do it now. It's basically so it's just a tool and kind of short circuit having somebody spend a lot of time, having us spend money educating somebody who's not going to be licensed.
Seems like that one gets a green light there. So.
Okay. Number three was allow the state to consider expunged or dismissed records.
Are we talking about these individuals, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Green, please.
Yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
And I haven't had a chance to read it, Senator Cruz, but would that be essentially suspending student teachers based on Oregon statutes? And what would be the impact of training a teacher in Oregon who might qualify in another state? An example that I think of was the proposal in the 07 session to allow to to allow certification of somebody who had been convicted of prostitution several years ago with the knowledge that there were several states that would reinstate that person. And would this impact our ability to train a teacher who might end up working in another state under a different statute?
Excellent question.
Chairs and Representative Greenlich, this would allow the commission to put on the National Clearinghouse the action our commission took. No other state is bound by it. Every other state may make their own decision about whether Oregon's action is equivalent to any of their standards or if they wanted to recognize it. But they would have notice, something they would not have today. So right now we run fingerprints on candidates and student teachers, and we learn all kinds of information that sometimes leads to them dropping out, and then they state hop.
They
state hop. They go enroll in another program, like in Washington or Idaho or California. What we would do, if we had the information that came back through the background check, which is what we discover, we would deny their right to apply in Oregon, which would then go into the National Clearinghouse. Now, every other state would have the right to consider that information if they wanted to license that person, but they'd at least have notice.
But you're essentially saying in advance, if you graduate from the College of Education, we're denying you something, essentially hypothetically. They might not ask for a license in the state of Oregon if they knew that. You talk about state hop as a derogatory term. If Utah might welcome them, but Oregon wouldn't, and you're saying, well, we won't, but that's more than, it's basically denying them before they apply. Is that the sense of it?
Representative Greenlich, it is the sense of this. The standard to revoke or suspend is very, very high. I can't think of any reason we would suspend their right to apply. We just give them time. What we're working on now with programs is for them to turn their fingerprints in as early as possible before people have invested heavily in their programs so that we can clear them. And they can have notice up front that if they made their application for licensure, they wouldn't run into the same problems anybody else is making an application for licensure.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, but I understand that, and I understand that would be an advantage to say to them, we want you to be fingerprinted in the second year of college, and we'll let you know whether Oregon will or won't certify you should you apply. But that's not the same as denying an application that hasn't been made, is it? I mean, we are treating it that way under this. I mean, state hopping isn't necessarily bad. If I'm eligible in one state and they want me, and I'm not eligible in this state, there isn't any reason why I can't train in this state and then go to wherever.
Representative Greenlich, we had a case where a student teacher molested a student and then left the state and enrolled in a program somewhere else, but our criminal justice system didn't pursue them. But we had enough information that we could have taken an action, but we had no jurisdiction.
Dave, if I can point out too, in different language, it's permissive for future standards and practices. May issue a public record manager to stand or revoke if it's not mandatory.
Well, I actually have no problem sanctioning somebody who molests a child. I think that's absolutely wrong. But that's not the only issue you're going to be raising. You're going to be raising whether, for example, they have been convicted of some crime. For example, if Mr. Chair went off and solicited a prostitute when he was 21 years old, and therefore had prostitution on his, a conviction for prostitution on his record, which meant he might be able to teach in 12 states, it would seem to me you're denying him an application when he hasn't applied. Doesn't make a lot of sense if
if he would, in fact, be qualified in other states. Perhaps he had no intention of ever applying to you.
Representative Greenlee, and then the other state could take that into consideration, just like we would if that state had something that wasn't on our list or something we didn't consider at the same level they do.
It's important. We'll discuss it further.
Thank you. Ms. Chamberlain, you indicated that you were trying to get program candidates to get their fingerprints done early. Well, my son's in the program for over a year. So if they do it, you know, before they get into the program, then wouldn't they have to do it again before you gave them their license? Because what if the crime had been committed in that time period while they're in the program?
Madam Chair, you fixed a statute for us during the February session.
Oh.
And we now have 3 years between when they submit their fingerprints and they apply, which is good. And then when they make their application from the time we ran the fingerprints through the state police and FBI, we would run a LEDS check to catch anything intervening as a possibility. And they would only have to resubmit fingerprints if it had been longer than 3 years from when we received them.
And then my second question is marijuana considered a controlled substance?
Madam Chair, yes it is.
So if a college student, a person in a master's program, getting a teaching certificate, it's a violation because in Oregon it's a violation if he possesses marijuana. We could deny him teaching?
Madam Chair, we could, but we do not. I see it often.
It's permissible.
Okay.
It's pretty heavy duty system. I'm teaching myself.
But it hasn't happened since I've been here.
Why not?
It's a violation. Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Greenlee asked me why not. Under Bergerson in particular, and these folks aren't the Bergerson case, pretty much says that for most things we have to make a direct connection between the conduct and their ability to be an effective educator, which is an okay standard. It actually applies to almost all licensure boards. So marijuana in Oregon is a violation, and even though it's a controlled substance, it possessing the amount that rises to a violation doesn't really rise to a level of scrutiny in our office higher than a DUI.
Mm-hmm. That hypothetical prostitution conviction, I hope you're not running for higher office. I'll take the hypothetical. On my hypothetical conviction at 19 for prostitution, you have to prove a direct relationship between that and... Okay. I'm confused by your answer to the prior question.
Well, the prior question, there's a little provision in our statutes that says that the commission can deny a license to someone who has been convicted of certain crimes related to a controlled substances. My attorneys tell me violations aren't crimes. Misdemeanors and felonies are crimes. And that's one of the things that we take into account. So the prostitution is just kind of, it's carved in stone, a mandatory crime we have.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Greenlee, that's one of the things we were trying to take off that mandatory list. With certain restrictions that didn't go so well in the House.
Right, again.
But I'm glad to hear that point about marijuana, because it's quite different if you're a dealer or you're in possession of over an ounce, but simply in possession of small amounts is considered a violation of the Oregon law. And I agree with you. I think that is like a DUI, which I think is even more serious. So I'm glad to hear that, and that's where in my mind that still gives you the discretion.
Thank you for your questions and comments. Any further on LC 1232? Senator Cruz, yes, sir.
Can we move on to LC 1169?
Yes, please.
Okay. permit PSPP to take public action, i.e. record an offense in the National Clearing House in more than 5 years since a license expired and the offense is included as a mandatory disqualifying crime for licensure. Part of the issue here, and I'll maybe explain it a little bit more, is after oftentimes the litigation takes longer than the window of opportunity they have to restore them. So they could be suspended and it could be 8 years before there is resolution and conviction. And at that point, the SEC would have to fight the penalty. So this is just kind of catching a loop.
Questions, comments, concerns? Thank you, Sandra.
Okay, now we'll get to the fun ones. LCH 1234 require all school employees to be independent.
All school
questions. I will say that in the draft, on page 1, line 7, it says may. Didn't it say shall?
Senator, this has come up a few times. The background check is mandatory. There is another statute that addresses that. The may relates to how that background check will be done. Most likely it will be done by fingerprints. Well, plus is another option. So it's just, it's more of a method to get to the end result of the background check.
Sometimes the order.
There's an agreement.
You are the driver.
I have a question in front of the piece, if I may.
Please.
And I don't have any objection to this fact. But there was a lot of question of what happened to the fingerprints in getting them to help me a lot. And the notion that you put it on a card, goes to the state police, they digitalize it, and then they throw away the cards after it. But there's always been a curiosity about what happens in the FBI database. It's automatically now put every teacher in the city of Oregon into the FBI's database. The FBI's never answered it.
The state police led us to believe in our work group that the FBI does not keep these.
Well, we asked the state police to kind of specifically come up with this last year. The answer is he didn't know what happened.
But Nikki's right, that's what we were led to believe in our work group that nobody's a lot of that.
So we had a long discussion
of the state police.
Why the FBI?
We just asked the FBI that question.
It would be, I mean, we had a long discussion in work group on whether we should retain. And there was arguments both sides of the retention. We chose not to tackle that issue in legislation. But we are also led to believe in the appropriate time for the movies. So they're used for the purpose of them to go away. That's what we're told in committee. I have no reason.
Thank you, sir. Represent, in 2005, we did extensive work on fingerprinting in the General Government Committee and met with the same answer that we received. Since we can't legislate over the FBI, we're going to let us do that.
That's true. But you said you can find out what to do.
You can ask. And we did ask in 2005 as well, and we were told the same answer, but they were not
capturing it.
The FBI didn't do it? Well, there was not a public question.
Just a procedural question. For the fingerprints, is that between the school district and state police, or is it between the school district and the Department of Education? What's the process the school district goes through?
My understanding that the schools send it to the Department of Education, who then send it to the state police.
Yes, Morgan.
Chair Walker, Chair Buckley, again for the record, Morgan Allen, Department of Education. The information is sent to our agency. We have access. We, you know, send those along to the database. But I could check with our human resources director and get a specific answer as to how that procedure happens. But for all the non-licensed people that TSPC does not handle, so essentially all classified employees, so cafeteria workers, school bus drivers, anyone else that's in the employ of a school district, we perform those fingerprinting checks as a service to the school districts and charge them for that as well.
Your check is different than the one TSPC does. Yours is minimal. Correct?
No. I guess give me a second. Again, I'm not the HR expert, but essentially the way it works in, for the non-licensed personnel, so classified employees, is that school districts, and this is what LC 1234 is addressing. So it is conceivable under Oregon law right now that a night, let's say a nighttime janitor in a school district is only there, say, from midnight till 5 a.m. or something like that. It is conceivable they are not required by law to get fingerprinted, to get that job, if the school district determines that they don't have access to unsupervised children. So if you look at the statute, and it's 326.603 and 326.607 are the two statutes that we deal with when it comes to fingerprinting. In practical application, every single school employee is probably fingerprinted. But technically, they are not required to be, because the school district has the discretion to determine which classifications of employees have, quote, unsupervised supervision of students. So this is it's a kind of a technical change. And basically, I think what we talked about in the work group center, because you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you get it, essentially, if you are an employee of the school district, you collect a paycheck, whether you're the nighttime janitor or the school bus driver or the cafeteria worker, you will get the full FBI fingerprint background check.
Mr. Chair, this gets back to the part we're going to punt back to the full committee. Because we talked about who we're going to do background checks and how expensive we're going to be. But then you get into volunteers, smart folks, coaches, and all of that. And you can get into a lot of expense. And so what we decided as a group was, let's draw a clear bright line. And that bright line we chose was, anybody who is an employee of the school district will go through the full fingerprint background check. And for the volunteers, coaches, those others, we as a group decided we needed to gather some more information. So we're supposed to, we want to be looking at what district policies are as to how, because some do full fingerprint background check currently on volunteers, coaches, that sort of thing. Others do not. So we were kind of pointing in a direction of, rather than come down heavy-handed on everybody, let's see what the matrix of policies and procedures in the state is, and see if we can kind of massage it together, whether it's and see what would fit best for those who are the volunteers in the school. So that was the third bright line, and that's the point.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe another way to look at this is, where is the incidence of offense? Is it occurring within the employees that are employed by the district, or those that are assistant coaches, where have we had offenses? And if the offenses lie, if you have anything that is kind of support group, then you want to think about improving it.
A couple of the issues that came up for us was, if you're dealing with volunteers and you're going to submit them to full background check, fingerprinting, and all that, are you discouraging people from volunteering, which we didn't want to do? We got into issues of what defines unsupervised contact with kids, and quite honestly, if you have a smart reader reading to a kid at a table in the school library with a librarian there, that could still be unsupervised because you don't know all of the conversation. So there's just a ton of gray there. So So our intent with where we ended up was we were scoring tokens. They should go through the whole thing, whether it's a nighttime chamber or not, because there could potentially be contact there too. But we know that there are a lot of school districts that have developed policies for how they handle volunteers, how they handle the coaching staff, different things like that. And we kind of, what we asked for was, bring us your policies, let us take a look at it and see what we think of, what exists, and what we would like to give you more advice.
Senator,
it's more of a policy issue rather than the administration potential.
Who's paying for that?
Yeah. They're part of the workforce. So.
My understanding, Mr. Chair, is that a number of districts started hiring coaches from independent companies because they couldn't afford to keep them on staff. So then, I'm not sure those coaches then are employees of the district, whether they're on contract or what they are. But I can tell you that there are plenty of coaches who have abused children. And so, for me, I'm not going to pass a bill if you don't get me to.
No, okay. One bill is enough. But this is giving these people, then you can also get into, for example, the elementary sports program in my hometown, which is like the Boys and Girls Club. So, all of those coaches. The volunteers, number one. Number two, they're not under the jurisdiction of the school district. So, but the school district does have a policy in place to deal with that arrangement. And so I want to be able to look at what sort of policies school districts have put in place, what they have implemented, and what sort of safeguards they have brought into their system before I turn on.
And it seems Ms. Richardson points out to me that a contract has been added.
Right. So if they're paid,
We want to protect the kids, but I just caution us in working through this that we don't create another volunteer ethics situation where nobody wants to step up and volunteer to read the kids. I had a question of Morgan about the expense of the fingerprinting and background checks. Is that borne by the Department of Education at this point?
Mr. Chair, no. I'm looking at my notes because I know we provided this to the worker, but Representative Huffman, I believe that the FBI fingerprint background check, we charge $62 for that. That includes the full cost of the FBI's portion of that, which is probably $50+, and then we charge a small administrative fee, so it's a self-funding program within our agency. So,
I would just caution us, to not exacerbate a problem with unfunded mandates or something like that.
And Representative Huffman, just to follow up, I think this is a real important distinction for the committee, and we talked a lot about this in Senator Cruz's work group, is the difference between the FBI fingerprint background check and the state police or LEDS check.
Right.
And the LEDS check, which school districts in 326-607, they right now, a school district could choose to require all of their volunteers to get the $5 state police background check. That they already have the authority to do in statute. And I think the question that our work group grappled with was, should those people be getting sort of the full FBI background check for all the reasons discussed, costs, is it going to encourage or discourage people, and those other concerns.
I thought LEDS was 10.
22.
Is it 5? And quite honestly, if you look at all the volunteers in the state, it's quite a large cadre. And 5 was significant on the ads, because if you've done something, it's in ads. If you're not saying who you truly are, then that's not going to, if you're using false ID, you're not going to catch a person. But that is probably an incredibly rare incident where somebody's going to volunteer to be a smart reader and use bogus ID to do it.
I'm like here's a question. Is this what you're waiting on then, is to see what districts across the state are doing with these volunteers? Because I know a lot of the schools just require a lot to check on volunteers.
And a lot do, and I think some some have kind of bifurcated their system depending on what their involvement with kids are, and there are some districts who their coaches, they background or they fingerprint check, and for others they let's check. Some probably don't do anything, but we're looking more at the cost effectiveness of it and what we can actually afford and what's and what will bring us the safety measures we want. And just see what there is out there and potentially, you know, have a policy recommendation.
Do you have that by approval?
Will we? Yeah.
Okay, so this is separate and apart from that. So the $5 less check for volunteers would be a separate bill.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Representative Rubin, thank you for patience.
I just want to say, a couple things, Commissioner. I think that what we're doing is important and appropriate. There's no child should be subjected to anything. So in order to do the better. But I want to make sure that people understand there are thousands of teachers who are working here are doing the right thing. And sometimes when we get into these fields, we forget that most of them are doing all the right things. They are protecting kids and it's a safe environment for our children. And we lose sight of that sometimes. There are lots of ways that predators go and find places to interact with children. Hopefully we can make the schools not one of those. And doing these kind of things can help. But I think sometimes we forget that there are a lot of people who are just doing the trying to do the right thing. And I worry that we do put stumbling blocks in front of people who want to come and help, and they just figure, I'm not going to look. The leads check works pretty well for a lot of those. I still think that you have to be diligent and watch the people who are interacting and watch what interactions are happening. And so the first bill we talked about really understanding, being able to identify and doing other things, is maybe the most important, because what you want to be able to do is be able to identify who it is out there that's grooming kids and doing other things. And there's ways to understand and know that behavior. And that's, to me, the single most important. These kind of things can help. But I appreciate the caution with which they approach this. And for all school employees, when you give them access and if they're in the building, then coming back to the building if you're a night custodian to do something is something you might do. And so checking that person, absolutely, I think it's the right thing to do. So we keep those people out in the first place. But it won't prevent everything, and it's just the most important. Thank you for the effort.
Does anybody have anybody? You guys doing great. Vicki.
This is just a footnote to what Representative Brogan just said. The vast majority of people we take some of our most severe actions against have no criminal records at all. And so criminal background checks can be a false security, and I just hear what he says.
Well, by the same token, you can do a last check, you can do fingerprinting, and if they're on the front end of their criminal career, you're not going to find them. It's simple, and quite honestly, folks, we're never going to build a foolproof system. Never are. It's impossible.
Okay. We'll move on to LC 1233.
Okay. This is one that is very simple. Currently, if somebody has made a false statement on their application, they are denied. That's it. And we were presented with a lot of scenarios where somebody may have had something happen when they were a teenager. They thought the record was expunged, and it wasn't, and so they have said, no, I have nothing, because they truly thought that was the case. And currently, the department has no option. This is going to give the department the discretion and the option for some minor thing that somebody has forgot about. If they don't write it down, they aren't automatically disqualified. That's basically it.
Hey, let's say Clint.
How often do I get a second to sit next to outside the college? So this actually gets back to a prostitution question. What we discovered in committee was that bill last session would have actually made it harder on former prostitutes than current law, because they could get expunged for 3 years, and that bill would have actually hurt former prostitutes instead of helping them in person. So would this help preserve the right for someone to have expunged but then not have to talk about it? And therefore, because I think the answer we got was, if it's expunged, technically the question still says, were you ever convicted? But if we don't ever know about it,
I'm glancing at legislative counsel. Representative Fenn, I don't know the answer to that question. We have to think about that, sort of walk through the scenarios. But again, just to echo what Senator Cruz said, I mean, what we're intending to do here is right now, let's say you apply to be a custodian at a school, and you had some minor indiscretion when you were in college, and you were convicted of a misdemeanor, and it was 25 years ago, and you go to apply for a job, and you know, I have a copy of the form right here, and it basically says, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Say you forget about it, the expungement issue and stuff, and they say no, and then we run the check, and it comes back yes. They automatically cannot get that job. I mean, they are done right there. And just one clarification is that we're not talking about discretion on the list of mandatory crimes. So those things, all the things that currently disqualify you from being either a licensed person from TSPC or a school, classified school employee, those all still stand. But what we see, and I know Ms. Chamberlain sees this too at TSPC, I mean, you see these sad stories of these people that literally one small indiscretion, they've turned their lives around, it was 25 years ago or something like that, and they just literally forget and just have to say sorry. Cannot be custodian or some other classified position.
Well, another example of what Warner's talking about, the same person currently comes in, and any crime, he says no, you do the background check and it shows up. A year later, he'd come back in and say yes. I mean, you know, let's say he forgot about it, but obviously, because he was denied because of it, a year later, he will remember it, and like, yes, so, you know, and then he gets hired. So how much sense does that make? So this is discretionary to allow the department to say, you know, if you had said yes, we'd hire you, but because for some reason you said no, we won't.
Representative Clem, I think the way we would approach it is someone with one, perhaps two minor offenses 20, 30 years ago, we would probably say, okay, you may have forgotten, maybe not have understood this is on your record. If someone comes in, and they've got 5, 6, 7, 8, one that's like 6 months old, one that's 3 years old, and they say no. And even if it's not on the list of mandatory crimes, we say, come on, you're disqualified. That's sort of, I think, where we're trying to get.
So, can we take a question one more time? Does this one form?
It says, I'm looking at, this is our fingerprint-based criminal history verification. And then we have a warning, a gigantic warning in bold that says, warning, this section must be complete and accurate. It is automatic grounds for denial of employment or termination of employment to make a false statement regarding criminal history. And then I think the pertinent section is Section 8. Have you ever been convicted of any crimes listed on the register of this form? Section B, have you ever been convicted of a major traffic violation or crime listed under B on the reverse side? And then C, it says, a crime includes a felony or misdemeanor. Have you been convicted of any other crime not listed under A or B? So that's C, is the section where they get tripped up. A and B, I believe, include all the mandatory crimes that would disqualify you from being an employee. And C is that, you know, minor in possession, a marijuana misdemeanor in college, and that's where people get tripped up on.
So, I know we're going to get out of the prosecution, but if you had your still need to answer yes to that question, even though a background check wouldn't show up.
Again, I'm not an attorney. Glancing at the two attorneys at the table with me, I think you're correct.
Just first of all, that standard does not apply to the people who apply in our office, and I hope you keep that clear. That's only for the folks who apply at ODE. We have discretion to make those calls, and I think that's what they're asking for. The issue is how complete the criminal record is that we find. We don't always know that records are expunged, but we may have a record of the arrest or a record of the conviction. And so we have to start with the belief that they made a false statement. And sometimes attorneys don't file papers when they think they did, or there's all host of reasons why that would happen. And sometimes courts don't follow through and wipe them off the criminal records. So we just encourage people to be as honest as possible, and we'll just tell them in the future you don't ever have to answer yes because you've proven this record's been expunged or you've proven that this crime has been dismissed. But the other thing they would have to prove if they did answer no and we had evidence that they'd been convicted is they'd have to prove they didn't lie. You see? So that's kind of the dilemma they get caught in.
So finalize the nonprofit on that bill. If the former prosecutor had the record expunged, if you could after 3 years with your they could tell you I had it, but it wouldn't be them automatically under the list of the list that a current prosecutor was on the list. If they had expunged, you would not have it.
Legally, we could go either way. What my attorneys tell me, we have discretion to go either way. We could say that's been expunged, we don't have to take it into account. Or we could say that it's really the underlying conduct, the way he wrote the statute, that we could look at. It was sort of under the same circumstances that Morgan was outlined. Was it recent? You know, how long has it been? What had happened since?
Chair Buckley and Chair Walker and Senator Hass, and Vicki, please jump in. TSPC has that discretion. ODE does not. Statutorily, it's a. You could have the greatest reason or excuse or a perfectly logical explanation as to why you said you have never been convicted of any crime, and it doesn't matter. We can't take that into consideration. It's an automatic disqualification. We have no discretion.
Madam Chair?
Yes, when someone's record has been expunged, and you get asked that question, have you ever been convicted of a crime? You can honestly and legally say no.
Correct.
Because it's been expunged. So you don't have to say, it's yeah, but it's been expunged. You don't say anything. You can say no.
And I think, Senator Walker, one of the things we talked about, Senator Cruz's work group, and some other people mentioned this, is that we still have instances where people thought it was expunged, or technically it was expunged, but the FBI never updated it, or perhaps it slipped through the state police, or the attorneys didn't file the papers, so then we're stuck.
And I think that's what you're trying to get here, the same thing TSPC has. I mean, you have jurisdiction over that.
I just want to, it's going to come up sooner or later, but the newest thing we're running into is courts are actively and very quickly destroying all records that are older than 10 years old. And so when a candidate may have had something expunged, we may have a record of the conviction, they may have the order of expungement, and it, they might have difficulty producing the paperwork, and then you just have to say, I believe you, or I don't believe you. I mean, it's awkward. It's messy. If we had it, if it were really clean, these would be easy answers. But we got to use some human judgment. It's usually fairly long.
There's a little bit.
Just to clarify what Senator Walker said, because I totally agree. If it was expunged, legally expunged, they can answer that question. And even if it shows up on the record and the department looks at it and says, you didn't tell us the truth, if they can prove that it was expunged, they answered it correctly and they could be hired even today. If they can show the proof. And yeah, that sometimes is their attorney's job, their defense attorney.
I go just one step beyond that, because the record may no longer exist. And they that it's still, the FBI still has it, but if they believed it was expunged, even if they can't prove the documentation, then it is a judgment call, either the TSPC or the department, and you know.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I'm just saying,
right.
They can prove it.
Right.
There.
But if it's a reasonable explanation, and it's a believable explanation, should they be able to get a job, I say yes.
This draft says, we're going to move forward with airplane agreement. You want to wrap this quickly, LCA?
Yeah, you mentioned the question of arrest records. And that came home to me a couple years back when I was, in 1968, I was arrested for migrant camp trespassing with a couple of discs. I was dismissed. But one of those discs now, 40-some years later, applied for a job in Arizona, and the arrest showed up, but there was no records of the fact that it had been dismissed. So So he ended up being forced to figure out a way to prove, you know, I had to get a I had newspaper clippings in my file, things like that. I was able to get him enough material, but how does an arrest, I mean, how do you deal with an arrest record that comes out for which there's no disposition shown anywhere in the record? This problem was transferred from state court to federal court, and it was dismissed in federal court, so it was never linked back to that, to the state court. So he almost didn't get that job because of that 40 years ago.
Representative Greenleaf, we run into that all the time. There was a great article in the Oregonian, I think, in the last 6 months about Oregon and arrest records. Oregon's a state that does not allow their arrests to be erased. So we have to deal with that. The problem that we run into is often we'll get the FBI report from other states and all we have is the arrest. So that would have been Arizona's situation. Then we have to compel the person to prove to us that the arrest didn't result in a conviction some way. And actually, even though the courts are purging their documents, they're not purging their final outcomes. And most of the time, they can tell us that they don't have a record of a conviction and some court clerk will sign, but all the documents have been destroyed. We actually have fairly reliable ways. I mean, I'm sure they're not foolproof. You can't dump them underwater to tell whether they're telling the truth or not. But we take all of that into account. And if you have no criminal record in between that 40-year-old arrest and anything else, that weighs heavily in favor of the applicant. So.
You really felt it seriously.
Yeah.
That's very reassuring. Incidentally, you can get an arrest expunged, but it's very complicated.
Senator Chris, thank you for the work with your work group. Thank you for bringing forward these proposals. And I actually do look forward to the discussion with Fred Cosa and the different issue. It's important for us.
We'll have that. And we're also going to get a report from the private schools. And the other issue that we chose not to deal with was that it's something that needs to be discussed is the potential expansion of the mandatory crimes list. Especially if we're looking at ID theft and things like that. Does that play into it? We chose not to go into it, but number one, we kind of ran out of time. And energy and other
things. Very good. Thank you, Senator. The second work group that the committee set forth went through many different proposals that had been brought up in the June meeting. It was nicknamed the Bergeson Work Group. We looked into a variety of issues. First off, we looked into creating licensure for mental illness if an applicant was found mentally ill by state or federal court. The work group decided this is a redundant given the other regulations already in place and trying not to increase or complicate matters. We decided to move away from that then. Similar with the second suggestion, which is to allow private approvals of borderline conduct. There was concerns raised about consistent application of what a private approval for borderline conduct might be and what the role of the employer was. So again, the work group discussed this from all sides and could not find a positive way forward. Third, we did consider the idea to have all licensed educators report misconduct to TSPC within 30 days. The work group determined this would be redundant given our current mandatory reporting requirements. We decided not to pursue that option. There was a proposal to require TSPC to create a set of guidelines similar to the state of Washington's guidelines. After a good deal of discussion, this was similar, I think, to the fingerprinting issue, the volunteers issue. Given that school districts are paying a great deal of attention to this issue and already have guidelines in place for their districts, it was decided that a one-size-fit-all was not the way to try to address this. And again, if there's any questions on that, that'd be fine to discuss. There was a proposal to adopt an immunity provision for reporting to TSPC that's similar to what exists for mandatory reporting, so the TSPC would be immune. The group agreed that immunity was already essentially provided within current law, though not explicitly, and therefore the option did not need to proceed further at this time. We did hold it open in case there seemed to be a need for to further pursue it. what we did move forward on, LC 1222, it puts limits on paid administrative leave when a investigation is being conducted. Take a quick look at that. In short, it's not permissible for an investigator who is under investigation for boundary violations with the OAR designated to be employed in a position that is direct unsupervised conduct with a minor or public school student until a legal finding from the investigation has been rendered. This prohibition includes employment in public schools, community colleges, universities, and licensed daycare facilities. So that is the first of three that our group sent forward. Is there any question or concern on LC 1222?
Looking for a representative agreement because there is the definition of education provider.
The other one is there's no clear definition of boundary.
Creating
a park.
That's
so it makes it a little hard to understand how clearly this would be if I don't know partly at least what the consideration is.
Do not define that part because it is so difficult, and we basically have to be looking at each individual's circumstance and situation to know. So, yes, just the minimal amount of guidance is provided in statute. There's a little bit more guidance that will be provided in a rule, but it is supposed to be looked at on a case by case basis.
I'm just saying that this is one that I feel very strongly about. This is how grooming and other kinds of things take place with respect to boundaries and safety. But the issue is, it is difficult to decide, and it is very, very difficult to prove. And this is a big problem when it comes to special ed students, especially those that can't communicate for themselves and would not be listed in court as a because they testimony in those cases. So it's one that I think is really important for those of us in administration or others so that we have a clear identification, so we know what kind of things those boundaries are, so that we can actually proceed with the case. If we don't have at least a good description of it. Proving it to the point where you can actually suspend somebody is going to be, and this is one we'll fight on.
Was there any investigation into definitions of boundary violations in other states?
Chair, yes, there was. OAR 584020003510CV, which was extremely circular. It was just basically boundary violation is a violation of boundaries. It really didn't help very much.
The psychologist board doesn't have I would think doctors or dentists or psychologists have those issues.
I did not check their statutes. We tend to look at, I just handed out the definition of sexual misconduct because one of the bills said to have ODE define it, and we've had it defined for a number of years, and it's basically any physical or verbal conduct which creates a hostile educational environment for the student. So that's fairly encompassing. What might be a boundary violation for me might not be for Hannah, let's say. So the investigation hinges around, was the student uncomfortable and why, and what was the conduct? So, because each student defines his or her boundary, essentially, and that's something that you have to take into account. The other thing we've discovered is that the treatment providers for sex offenders have done an outstanding job of identifying behaviors and definitions in this area, and we've just started to collect some of that, and we might be able to incorporate that into some of our books. It won't be so simple.
And the issue to me is if it is going to come under the same standard that you do for sexual harassment, I think then it does become clearer. And then it becomes the definition of the person receiving as opposed to the person employing it. So, you know, and having had experience with people who crowd people's face, and other people don't like that, having to go and tell them what you're doing is inappropriate. Well, I don't mean to. That doesn't matter. You need to take one step forward back as soon as you get close, because obviously it's not working. And, I mean, you can do that, but in this whole thing, you have to recognize that part of the issue will be initial identification and then telling the person you need to stop it. And then if it persists, then you have a problem. And it will be the persistence that I think we're going to have to deal with.
Any other questions, concerns, comments? LC 122.
there will be really further discussion. On LC 1223, the work group decided to put forward the proposal that would suspend or revoke a teaching license or registration during the appeal process if suspension or revocation is lifted on inappropriate sexual conduct involving students. Just to clarify again, Vicki was great. Just to give Finland her due here in our work group, at least she spent most of the time just being the center of attention, being kind of hammered with every idea and proposal. But this did seem to be one that did rise to the work group's priority list. That just to make sure that during the appeal, the DSPC still has the right to suspend or revoke the license. Fairly straightforward.
So John is going to revoke the license.
Chair Sanders. This is a licensure version of 379, effectively. I was trying to think of an analogy. But right now, so long as the applicant or person who has a license continues to appeal the commission's decision, their license remains active. We are required by law to allow their license to stay active, which is very consistent with our beliefs that people are innocent until proven guilty. I can't quibble with that. The problem is that as you know, the justice systems tend to grind slowly, and there are cases where we would like to make the case that this is a case where the license ought to be revoked and the revocation stays in place until they complete their appeal. And Senator Walker was familiar with a process where they can appeal to the circuit courts to actually have their license prove that they shouldn't have to have their license revoked during that period, and which would be okay. I think that would be okay. But in other words, if there was an abuse of authority in our office for all revoked licenses under appeal, we're going to stay that way, then that would be a problem. But I would see a case, sincerely, most of these cases, well, I'm not going to say that. Frankly, some of the cases where we ultimately won have taken a long, long time, and the person persisted that they were innocent, and we prevailed and believed that was the right outcome. There aren't a lot of them, but there are a few.
There's a really
good. The other part of this one was to make sure that the identification was made to another state. If I was appealing my state license had not been revoked, I could leave that job for another state, and when asked a question, has your license ever been revoked, you can say no. And then get another job. And so on. And I think there have been situations where that has happened.
And I want to be clear that when we discover we've made a mistake, we make sure that national record is ended quickly.
Very good, then. We'll move forward to LC 1223. And the final one our work group had was, concept 1224, which would add PSDC employees to the list of mandatory reporters. And there is a, in your notebook, there is a letter from, let's say, council concerning this. So it would not be in confidentiality requirements. It would allow KFC personnel to be added to the list of mandatory reporters. Questions or concerns?
Just a little one from Hannah. Why, on line 20, are you replacing the word defined by described? Is this just a new thing? Or okay, you know, you guys go through these new descriptive words.
Well, Chair, I don't know if it's a new thing. It's just technically it's not defined. It's just correcting the terminology. There's chapter 163 does not have any place that says sexual abuse means. There are three statutes that kind of describe it. It's just a to correct. cleanup, yes.
But the Scrivener's Wheel. I love the Scrivener's Wheel.
All right, no comments. Person Ripple.
So, we have a CSPC investigator who's investigating allegations, and they come to the belief or the suspicion that it's correct. They have to report the same one they're investigating.
Representative Roblon, I don't know. I have a lot of real mixed feelings about this proposal. Right now, the investigators don't have to worry about anything other than objectively investigating, and this is going to impose a new decision they're going to have to make at some point. I can't think of a single instance where we've known of something that DHS or law enforcement didn't. If we thought it was child abuse, it could have been there. It just seemed really troublesome to me. Hannah's letter of advice here conflicts with what my AG has told us. And so I think very bright people can disagree about our confidentiality requirements. I would love her opinion to be accurate, frankly, because I think it's appropriate, and there's times when I felt that we should be able to contact law enforcement, and we've been advised by our attorney that we cannot. So it would be nice to have it debated a little differently, at least to that extent. I would like to open that door. I'm still a little reticent about the reporting thing. I'm not opposed to it. I just, my little gut tells me it could create more problems than it helps, but I don't have any real hardcore data to prove that.
Senator Cruz.
Okay, Vicki. Your investigator comes back healed, and their finding are that they believe there was sexual abuse. And you're telling me that your lawyers, I mean, at that point, you're reporting, aren't you?
We have not yet run into that case, I believe. The problem is the second I find out or my AG finds out, we have a duty to report. So I'm pretty certain I haven't seen it. We're not protected otherwise. I'm talking about we discover all kinds of possible criminal conduct through our investigation that the police have no idea about. It's not the police. I'm saying if we could disclose criminal conduct or other things we found in the course of an investigation earlier, that would be that would be wonderful. I'm sure there's a lot of people who disagree with me, but it's always felt not. It feels awkward to have to treat that information as confidential until you enter an order. As soon as you enter an order, you can submit the. We've done that. We've given the order to law enforcement, but not until.
This one won't change. This won't change that because this is only about mandatory reporting of sex.
No, correct. No, I'm saying I like her opinions.
Right.
Broad.
Yeah.
From my comment.
Further questions, comments on this proposal? Seeing none, we are through the list of the
chairman. If you would allow me privilege to go back to 1172.
Absolutely.
Do we have some clarification as to what the outcome was of our discussion with respect to the school employee and position of authority as to which direction this legislation is taking in the direction? Or are we leaving the language the same?
Right now, the conversations I recall having ended up is that there is a question to whether we will be adding a definition of an employee to this bill, but that question wasn't answered. Is that the question you're asking right now?
I think we have a consensus on it.
I don't believe we reached a consensus on it.
The other question I have, an affirmative question, is we have three categories, age 18, 16 and 14. Why? And that's existing statute.
Right.
Now, those are forfeited. It seems to me that maybe if you do just one age, that's age 18 or a student. When you look at the offenses that are listed.
I believe, and here I can correct me, that if you're not trying to change the current statute concerning rape in the third degree, which is currently a sexual intercourse by any person with another person under 16 years of age, we're trying to add to the statute an additional category of that crime would be a student in grade 12 or below, and the person is a school employee in position of authority of a student. So I don't believe if we just change it to all to age 18, we'd be changing the classification of rape in third degree.
I can put the language of section 5 to reference under 14 years of age or a student in grade 12 or below, which includes students older than 14.
Right.
This is an issue that I think needs a lot more work.
Trying to clarify, if I can, I believe what we're trying to get to is we want to make sure any student in grade 12 or below is protected by this, and we're running into the in terms of their relationship to a school employee and position of authority, and we're into a little bit of confusion with the language covering the 14 years of age. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That was interesting as well. So we'll keep looking at that and try to get that to as very clear as we can. Senator Cruz.
The other point clearly is the way it's written, section 1B is the way I read that. How do we find authority? For example, if I'm teaching a student in my class with clear authority, if I'm a teacher that that student isn't in my class, do I have authority?
Right.
I think Representative Roblin made that point.
Right.
To a degree, in trying to expand the mirror, which is why I suggested the word or
right.
be added in there. So it's a school employee or. So that would, at that point, that would include any school employee, whether they're in a position of authority or not, but the position of authority would also expand to include somebody who's a coach or something like that.
Well, when I was in school, a bus driver told me to do something.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even know why we have that phrase, position of authority. So I agree with the rules.
I would agree.
You would.
That's why you're in the principal's office.
The principal told me to stay away. So Senator Haas, you're saying just as a school employee, period.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't defer anything else, but I would err on the side of simplicity and position of authority.
If I recall, was this came on the discussion, was it Minnesota that had the statute that we were looking at originally? Do you remember?
Lots of states have it. Yeah,
right.
I don't know which one.
Would you be surprised to look to see if the statute that whether it addresses this, whether one is written that simply says currently?
Sure. I do have some of the information in the file for this, and every state took a different approach. Like some of them would say in fiduciary relationships, someone lists every position, coaches, teachers, whatever. And so this was just to throw out some language to open up the debate, which obviously it has, to kind of figure out which direction we want to go.
I guess the personal reason I chose position of authority was to try and reflect what I thought we were going after, which was, you know, even if somebody went to a different school, to try and capture that. It's not just the school employee or the students goes to school, but any school.
I do believe that that's what the committees are coming up with, is a concern about it should be. I think if I'm thinking of the committee correctly, the committees would like to be whether that, whether it's direct supervision role over the student.
Mr. Chair, I believe that Roger Steph and Don have been signed in the past. Simplified it even more, like the center, just dropping off the school employee for a period, and it's clear and distinct.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the
nation's
time. Oh, I'll try that.
Well,
I think that's a major change. Essentially, it would be substituting anybody under 12 for, I mean, anybody in the 12th grade or below for 14 years of age. I think if you're going to do that, that's not a simple thing.
Which are you talking about? This position,
well,
of authority?
Let's take page 3 and
1. Are you talking about the position of authority?
Well, the suggestion was we cut out any kid in the 12th grade or below, and not talk about school employee or anything else.
I think Evans kept it to school employee. They just haven't had to just continue to be.
Is that right, Senator?
We're talking about school employees.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
All right. What was that, Clint?
The trigger was essentially graduation from high school and the day after, a different story than what it was about. You know, it's not that kind of relationship. I have a high school principal that still has a position of authority over me. I'm trying to figure out a way to get away from it.
Report him. That's simple.
We're going to share my story. We're going to go away from this discussion as quickly as possible. There's a good conclusion. Yes.
But I have a question for you to go back to 1222. I'm sorry I had to leave.
Absolutely.
It's that question of education provider. And I'm not really an expert on this, but it seems to me creating a different definition for education provider, unless this definition is used somewhere else, I would recommend either including private schools and not doing the list, or if we want this list and then to exclude private schools, then just include this list and don't define it as education provider. Because I think it having different definitions of the same term in different statutes definitely leads to trouble. Potential trouble. We're talking about 1222, and you have a definition of educational provider.
Yes.
And you said it's a different definition from what's in the basic statute defining what an educational provider is.
The only difference is that it takes out the private.
But it's different.
Yes.
So my proposal is either include private if there's no reason not to, and take away the list so that it just says educational provider as defined in the other statute, or we take out the educational provider part and refer specifically to the list. I'm just suggesting that having two different definitions for educational provider in two different statutes causes the possibility of confusion. Because then the next time I use educational provider, I have to define whether I'm talking about this statute or the other statute. Or I can define it again some third way, which isn't what I think we would want in statute. So I was wondering, I missed the discussion. Why did we leave private schools out of this one?
I don't think there was any discussion really related to that. It was a decision I had made while drafting, realizing that would probably be up for a policy discussion later. It's just that we usually don't get into private school interactions at this level, but obviously we can.
Doesn't the Teachers Standards and Practices Commission license schools in private?
No.
Okay. Well, then I would take out the educational provider and simply say in these institutions.
don't know which one it is that's the problem.
Probably not that easy to fix, but I see your issue and I can figure out what to do.
Yeah,
if you take on education provider, every place in the statute that you reference education provider, you're going to have to create the whole list.
No, this is a special definition of education provider. There is a definition of education provider in a different statute, in the basic statute. It does not. It is not this definition.
Right. So basically, representative.
What's that statute that includes it?
I think it's 339-370.
Yeah. 370. It does include private schools. It says education provider is, and it gives a list, and it includes private schools.
And the reason it's not used in private schools is not used in this one is because it has no jurisdiction.
No, I don't have a problem not using private schools. Or I would say educational providers not excluding private schools. I wouldn't create a new definition of education provider. That's all. Yeah, either way.
Okay, but private schools do employ our licensed employees. So if you don't include them, they wouldn't be required to give notice of restriction.
They're not included here.
Right. No,
I was saying is either include them, if that makes sense, or don't create a brand new definition of education provider. You know, if we want to include private schools, then we simply don't include A through G, and just. And then it would be, if you wanted to define an education provider, you'd refer back to the statute.
You could make a definition, a new definition of public providers, and just call it public school or whatever. What's the definition we're talking about?
Is a charter school a public institution?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So we anticipate some interesting options being brought forth by Ledge Council. Good point. Members, I appreciate all your time and patience today, and Hannah and Vicki, thank you so much as well. Is there anyone else here who has not had an opportunity to comment on the proposals before the committee who would like to do so? Please.
Kirkwood. I live in Beaverton and I'm representing Oregon Substitute Teachers Association.
Very good.
And our concern is the sometimes false accusation of a teacher and how easy it is for this to go straight to the police, and then there doesn't seem to be any presumption of innocence. And it's happened more than once. And so we're hoping that when you are doing your deliberations that you could put in some safeguards that will assure a due process for anybody, but especially for teachers. We've had, actually there's a case right now. Thinking back, the teacher can't even remember or imagine what could have triggered this accusation. And there doesn't seem to be any way to prove that you're innocent once the accusation has been made. And so I'm not sure what would be done, but I believe a process that would involve the school administration, because they might be able to say, well, this student has had a problem of lying, or this student has maybe even been abused and now doesn't like that the teacher kept them in from recess, and maybe they know something about these very rules that can get rid of a teacher that they don't like. And I know that there have been some cases where an accused teacher has countersued, and the children who made the accusation admitted that they made up a story. It was kind of a game to them, but they didn't realize the seriousness of it as far as the teacher being taken to jail. And but we didn't really want to hurt them. We just wanted to make them lose their job. And so also I understand that there is something in the law where a person must register as a sex offender, and I'm not sure if a person would be, if a person is acquitted, they should not have to continually throughout their life register as a sex offender. So if you could make sure that that would be cleared up.
I believe that is current law. That if someone is acquitted, they do not have to register as a sex offender.
All right. But
we'll confirm that with you. First, I'd like to say thank you for coming forward and bringing these concerns. One of the reasons that both of our committees have been wrestling with this issue since the articles came out in Oregonian last spring is because we do understand that lives are at stake and people's reputations are at stake and their ability to be employed are at stake. And we're trying to take very seriously and make sure that we have a system that is fair, that protects children, but also protects the rights of teachers and the school personnel. So I do very much appreciate your comments.
Thank you. The definition of inappropriate touching, mm-hmm. I think, may not be clear to children, and I appreciated the discussions earlier about the education to children being age appropriate, because if they just report something that they feel uncomfortable with, I as a substitute teacher might come, I might lay my hand on their shoulder as an act of encouragement, but to them it wasn't. And so there needs to be a way that teachers can say, I had no sexual intention at all, and that can be believed.
Thank you so much. Greatly appreciate you coming forward. Thank you. Members, any further discussion on this issue? Again, thank you for your time and consideration. Senator Cruz. I think that is a consensus opinion.
And you don't get her.
We
get her back.
Any further comments for the good of the order? Representative Huffman.
Mr. Chair, for the last speaker, just so that maybe she'll feel a little better, in our first work group, that was one of the things that we discussed, was to make sure that the rights of the teachers were not circumvented or thrown out and guilty until proven innocent or something like that. So that was a big part of our discussion early on.
Thank you. Anything else? With that, I will close the House Committee, Interim Committee on Education, and pass the gavel to the Senate.
Can I leave 30 minutes?
Yes,
leave 30 minutes.
And I will adjourn the Senate Interim Committee on Education and General Government.
Okay.